Farewell and adieu to fair Ohioan lady. Oh, no, no, farewell and adieu to old lady from Ohio. For we've received orders for to sail back to Norfolk.
And we hope in the short time to see you again.
Wait, all right, so I'm just sitting here playing on my phone while Craig does more terrible voice work.
So you
was are, that an Irishman dancing?
So that is Robert Shaw, better known as Jaws. Quint from Jaws, the 50th anniversary. But we have some allusions to a fair lady from Ohio that may have never been seen again.
We'll get to there. We'll
have to listen in to find out who that is.
Uh-huh. All right. So welcome to Jawbone, and I apologize on behalf of the thousands of listeners for Craig's singing. And as the students already know, when he gets real animated, he does terrible accents. So well done.
I have been commended by many of my accents. You're just jealous.
No, you've also been told like the accents all sound the same, but that's, you know.
But that's because I'm doing – I repeat.
See, he's defensive, Rob.
I repeat certain accents for different classes
because they're
new to them.
So this is a very special edition of Jawbone.
They're all special.
I'm John. And here's Craig. And with us, we have a very elite, even special guest. One, Charles Stuppard. Did I say it right?
Perfect.
See? And we call him, we're going to talk about his book, Sea Tales by Sea Dog. And the title, the official title is Sea Dog, A Seafaring Captain's Lessons in Leadership.
But today's episode will be Sea Stories with Sea Dog.
Sea Dog.
Which we're going to, letter C, dash, dog.
Yeah, like that's it. How we have
I like
labeled
it.
You.
I like it.
So we have Dr. Stuppard, who is one of our deans. And before we get on further to talk about the story Craig is alluding to, is could you tell us, and you tell us in this book, could you give us, as we do often, your life? How did you get to where you are right now?
Okay, it's a long story, but if you want me to start with the book, how did the book came about? So I started writing my PhD just as I was the base commander at Little Creek and Fort Story, putting those two bases together. Little Creek is a Navy base, and Fort Story is an Army base. And I was the joint base, the second joint base commander to what I would call joining two cultures. And those two cultures are so different. So it was quite a challenge to kind of put them together. And now it is one working, big, beautiful base.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
working together. But it took a lot of work to put it together. So as I finished my PhD thesis, I was getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning, every morning. So I would work and write from 5 to 7 in the morning. And it took me about 3 years to get my PhD thesis, defend the dissertation, and get my doctoral degree. But then an interesting thing happens the morning after is that I was still up at 5 o'clock in the morning with nothing to write. So I decided to get up anyway, get my cup of coffee, normal routine, and just start writing stuff just because I was awake. And then I said, my dissertation was about Abraham Lincoln, basically the effect of new technology on the military leadership of Abraham Lincoln during the Civil War. And I said, well, given that I just wrote about Abraham Lincoln, a leader of long, long ago, let's talk about a leader that is contemporary. So what I wanted to do is more like tell my grandkids the story of their grandfather and what he thought about leadership, given that the person who know myself the most, supposedly, is myself. And I said, well, I'll just write to my grandkids and rem stories, you know, just stories. Hey, I'll talk about the topic, tell you what I think, and ramble. And then 7 o'clock, get up, go to work. And I was just doing that days in and days out, just kind of rambling. And then it took me about 10 years of rambling until I finally got serious. After 5 years or so, I got serious. And I said, hey, let's actually start writing something good. So I kind of revise everything, the rambling, to turn it into more like a story, not a memoir, but more like telling my grandkids about life, how I see it, but also what I think about those events, those issues, like my own, their own personal grandfather's idea and thoughts about those world events or even ideas or things that I've read. And then after I kind of finished the book, I had about up to 850 pages of stuff.
The publishers didn't want that, huh?
Yeah, just stuff. Yeah. And then, so when I finally get a publisher, they're like, first, it's way too long. And second, we don't want a memoir. We want more on leadership. So we want to know more about what you think as opposed to what you've done. And we went about 50-50. So it took me another 2 years to kind of just like rewrite the book and more like focusing on the leadership lessons of those events as opposed to telling the story of those events.
But your story is also an important part here.
Yeah, we need the origin story because it's so a little unique.
It is different. We've got birth in a different country. We have switching services. We've got different domains. So tell us where you're born, how you came to the United States, and what was that like for you? As I recall in the book, I think you were 19 when you arrived, 19. And speaking little to no English.
Absolutely.
So take us through this.
Absolutely, very interesting story. So the story started way back in the beginning. So my family are from St. Mark in Haiti, and born there. My great-grandfather was actually a sailor, and he used to do commerce between Jamaica and Haiti, and met a young lady in Haiti, married her, and had some kids. So that's one. And then in St. Mark, you know, they grew up doing their thing, what regular people do. And then my mother met my mom when they were 8 years old, living as neighbors and kind of just like, you know, a little boyfriend, girlfriend kind of thing. But you know, the only romance was like maybe just take a look and eye. But that mm-hmm. was, there was no touching, no nothing. Yeah. For 8 years, when they were 8 years old, and when they were about like 18, 19, they got a scholarship from the church, American church. They had a scholarship, and they both went to Shaw University at Raleigh, North Carolina. And my dad graduated in 1947. So during World War II, mm-hmm. they actually at Shaw University studying. And so my dad got his degree in divinity and my mom in nursing and education. And they went back to Haiti. And for 50 years, I see that my dad took care of their soul, spirit, and my mom took care of their body in their mind, in terms of she was the director of the school for the church. So the American missionary kind of played a very important part of my life, because I remember the missionaries coming to church with my dad preaching. Those missionaries, man, I'm telling you, they were like almost like come from heaven. They would sing. And for me, they always drive nice cars, have a lot of money, just like John. And they were very, very nice and fine people. You know, I have very fond memories of the Americans coming to visit as missionaries. And then Dad went about 50 years doing that. But then there was a guy in charge of Haiti named Papa Doc Duvalier. And he was one of those dictators. Mm-hmm. People would just disappear overnight. It was like life. It's like you have an uncle who go to work and the uncle didn't come back. And it's like swallowed by a Papa Doc. Because, and why? Because he said something about justice or freedom or something that Americans take for granted. But that actually cost him his life. Like, hey, you know, you don't have to do what people say you have to do. It's like, yeah, you have to. All right, you're dead because you cannot help the people think. you know, under a dictatorship, people are not free to think. People cannot do whatever we do here. You know, so much that we take for granted in the U.S. is actually not for granted in other places.
Washington linkage coming?
So there absolutely
He did write about Abe Lincoln, the greatest president in the United States.
Number two. But but again, you spoke about American missionaries, but how did you, when did you, you know, how much access did you have to what America was or what America stood for? Because obviously you get here.
Yes.
But how, when, how is it, did it come from your parents? Is it from the missionaries where you understood that America is different than what I'm experiencing every day?
Yes. I think I got it mostly from my dad, from my mom, and the contact that I had with the missionaries. Because the missionaries that come and do the nation's work was under JFK, President Kennedy back then. They took out the message from the country, showing the world that we are a great nation, we are good people, and we do good work. And for me, that was really fascinating. For example, when people would go hungry, I remember the church would send bags of barley, butter, food, all kind of good stuff. And even as a young kid, like 12-year-old, I'm like, what kind of people would kind of just send free stuff to people that they don't even know? These people must really, really be good. Yeah. So that was my introduction to Americans being really good people, people who give freely. And even up to this day, different experience. Yeah, different experience. I'll tell you, even up to this day, I still strongly believe that Americans are great people, because if you're stuck anywhere on the road, a good Samaritan will always pull over and help you out.
Not Craig, though. Well, Craig's like, I'm going
to. Well, to be fair, there's other things that could happen if you're stuck on the side of the road,
fear.
Too.
Craig lives in fear.
Fair enough.
I would stop. And then I would, you know.
But yeah, people, maybe you're the type of person they're afraid of.
Yeah, well, that's true. So it works. No, so it's a great origin story. Little different from Craig and I's journey. We'll do an episode on our journey.
You should.
Now, you get to the U.S., you go to college. Why did you join the military?
Great. Yep. Good story. But again, from Greg's question, if I can go back. So my dad actually started being prosecuted by the president, and they actually put him in jail.
President of Haiti, I'm assuming.
But Papa Doc. Yes, Papa Doc. And they put him in jail. And my mother says, you know, I've given this country 50 years. I'm done. You know, and she left. And then she actually left us with my dad. But then they put him in jail. So we went to my aunt's house and lived there for about 3 years. And my mother said, okay, once you pass high school, which is a little bit different than American high school, because high school over there, it's like I had 5 years of Latin, 6 years of Greek, I had full physics, chemistry, all that stuff. And then you have no option of not studying because there's punishment.
So it's classical Greek education.
So punishment goes with not doing your homework.
So what I'm hearing is that American students are soft.
Yeah, that's what I got out of that.
Well, it's a different world, put it this way, with the Catholic Church and the fathers, the brothers, sisters. It's like, if you don't do your homework, it is not a good day.
I think, well, we're both lapsed Catholics in some way, so we all get there. Yeah,
you remember those days. Yep. So when I came here at about 19, barely spoke English, but although, like I said, I had about English for about three, four years.
But you spoke ancient Latin and Greek. You're like Marcus Brody in Indiana Jones.
And you spoke, French, but what, French. Would the French deem it to be French?
Yes, actually, they deem it to be old French, like the old classical French.
The OG as opposed to French.
As opposed to the Parisian French.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do the French Canadians speak French?
They speak a French called the Joual, which is also old French, where it's like old British, really old, and they didn't really bring it up to the 20th century.
When when I was in Quebec for hockey, they speak trailer park French.
Yes, that's what we call it. It's a little bit different. It takes some concentration to understand.
I know, we offended all the Quebec listeners.
You're getting letters now.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
So at 19, I came barely speaking English, and it took me it was very interesting to do the transition, and because I can read and I can understand, but the issue is that the Americans, the real Americans, they speak English way too fast for me back then. So I had to do the reading first, and then as I listen in, I can kind of like say, okay, yeah, they must be in page 20. But it was really hard for me to understand because they spoke way too fast. It took me some time for my brain to get used to it.
In the slang. We love slang. So I know that a lot of international students we have run through, sometimes they actually say their English gets worse as the year goes on because they process it more, but they're learning the new language, the slang, and it adds more mud.
Yes.
And we've had seen a couple guys, but no, that's my English is still ongoing. So is Craig's.
So you join the military, but you go first, not to the Navy, but to the Air Force.
Yes.
Take us through that decision.
You're very joint.
Yes, very joint, very joint. I agree with that. Yeah. So I managed to, after 3 years of being in the U.S., I managed to get accepted and go to Cornell and get a double degree in mechanical and aerospace engineering. Again, that was a little easier for me. As opposed to majoring in history, like John, because he outfell history gravely because of the language requirement.
But that you wrote about Lincoln.
Yeah, later on.
So we got you in the end.
later on, yes, you sure did. And I love history. I wish I could have.
So you go from the warmth of Haiti to the barren tundra of Ithaca, New York.
Oh, man, let me tell you, that was a shocker. That was a big shocker, especially my first snow. So graduated in engineering, and my first job was working designing airplanes for the U.S. Air Force. I work as a design engineer, work on the A-10. I was the weapons engineer for the A-10, work on the huge gun, Gal 8A, which is the size of a Volkswagen.
The infantryman's favorite
plane. Oh, yeah. If you're a tanker, you hear that thing. It sounds like a vacuum cleaner. You get out of the tank and run because you're dead. And then from after working on the A-10, I transitioned to work on the T-46, a new Air Force trainer, and I became the flight test engineer for that. And then a gentleman I was working with by the name of Dominic Capuano, Italian-American, saw something in me that I didn't see and said, hey, young man, you are a very promising, intelligent young man. If you want to join the club, you have to go pay your dues. And I'm like, Dominic, tell me more. He's like, well, you know, most of those guys up there, you see, like the director of engineering, the chief of R&D, those guys, there's another cloth that they have under this coat and tie that you don't see. It is that military cloth. I'm like, huh, tell me more. He's like, yep, this guy is an Air Force colonel. This guy's a Marine. This guy's Army. And if you want to join them, you have to go join the services. And then when you come back, maybe you might become one of them. So, huh? Is that how it works? So, therefore, in the book, the importance of mentoring. That's why John is now my mentor.
I thought it was the other way around.
but that guy certainly got his bonus from the recruiter for
that's
hooking
right.
you.
That's right.
I sure did.
That's right. No, that's good. Now you know, and then We won't take off credit grades from you on that.
We'll just blame Rob.
Yeah, we'll blame Rob because his phone went off last episode. Yeah. So now, Charles, then you. But why the Navy?
Well,
because the book title would be different if you kept into the Air Force. Air Dog.
Air Bud.
Oh, yeah. Or the Seaman or something. As it was Sea Dog, Sea Air, Seaman.
Yeah.
So, well, first, actually, because I was designing airplanes for the Air Force, I first went to the Air Force to sign up for the Air Force. But when I asked the recruiter about the process of joining the Air Force, he told me I just have to sign here, and then they're going to send me somewhere at Lackland Air Force Base. And depending on how I do, that would determine where I go. I said, no, I want to go. I know exactly where I want to go. I want to go to Wright Patterson Air Force Base and design airplanes for the Air Force. He's like, yeah, it doesn't work like that. You have to go past.
But at least the recruiter was honest with you, right?
Yeah.
There.
I'm like, what if I don't do well? He's like, well, then you might end up in someplace in Egypt or some in Zimbabwe or something. I'm like, nah, I don't want to do that. And I crossed over and saw the Navy guy, a young lieutenant by the name of Ray Baltera with his white uniforms. And he's like, take this test. I'm like, sure, I'll take a test. And I think I did well. Said, take this other test about aviation. He's like, so I took the test. I'm like, not only can I take the test, I can tell you and show you how to design it better. And he's like, oh, you passed. Okay, I'm going to send you to Pensacola. And then you're going to see the Blue Angels. And if you like it, we'll talk. If you don't like it, all expenses are on me. I'm like, deal. I went to Pensacola. Officer club, you remember back then, officer and gentleman. I came back. I'm like, sign me up.
So the movies and the white uniform got so another one.
There we go.
Yes.
Tom Cruise reference coming.
Yes. Yeah. And then that was it. So I went to the Navy. And actually, when I left Fairchild Republic, I told them I was leaving to join the military. They told me, no, you don't have to leave. We are going to give you a military leave of absence. And when you come back, your promotion will be waiting for you. And every year they keep sending me my dividend as being an employee. And then after about 6-7 years of getting those checks, and I'm like, yeah, I think I'm going to stay in. I told them, okay, stop sending me checks. I'm staying in the military. Like, okay, good move. Good luck with your life. And then I said, you know, if I make it 10 years old, at 10, I can make it to 20 and retire. And that was the deal. But the initial intent was to do 5 years and then go back as an engineer.
If that was John, he would have looked to pick up a third job.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
That's cold. But no one will get, like two people will get that, but that's fine. You continue with your naval career.
Yes, sir.
And then you mentioned, I think, you know, one of your jobs at Fort Story, where a young John used to go to the beach with his dad in Fort Story.
Yeah. There's a lot. There's actually giving another crossover with
yeah.
With
so this is your
Mr.
time,
Michael Scheck, later on in the episode.
No, but here's your time. Really, we want to get to the real, because we're hitting now 30 minutes. So,
oh, you want to talk about Halle Berry's story?
Yeah, that's the whole reason.
Just gave it away.
Yeah, you just Rob went to edit that out. So oh. Yeah, the thing that stands out, and we did find a picture.
We used our historian skills to find.
It's called the Google
screenshots and a brief video.
1986
of you meeting that lady from Ohio. The story's not in the book. So this is a Jawbone exclusive.
Just a Jawbone.
Jawbone exclusive. So it's 1986. You're at the Miss World pageant.
Yes.
Tell us, what are you doing there and who do you meet?
Well, I loved singing.
So does Craig.
Yes, I know. That's why Craig and I, we get along so well. Love singing. And also singing got me out of punishments, too. Yeah, get me out of punishment.
We're going to have to try that one day.
Yeah, get me out of punishment. So it's like when the squadron, it's like, you know, the PTing, doing punishment. And like, yeah, I have to go to the choir and practice it. All right, go to choir. And then so we would perform all over the nation. Actually, I get to be on stage with Sammy Davis Jr. And those guys.
So you're in the Rat Pack then?
Yeah.
Loosely.
Yeah, loosely. Very, very, very loosely. But then one of the performances we gave was Miss USA 1986 in Miami. And there is when I got a chance to see supposedly the most beautiful woman for each state. Miss California, Miss New York, Miss Ohio. And then there's a young lady by the name of Miss Ohio. And she was very pretty. She was about 19. And then she even signed my book on her picture. And then I talked to her. And I said, hey, what do you want to do when you grow up? She's like, I would like to be an actress and do a movie. I'm like, huh, all right, best of luck. So, you know, we talk. And then she
Is this the one that got away? That's where I'm going with.
Yeah, she actually did not win. She actually became, she actually was running up at number two. So right now, nobody remember. I don't even remember who was number one.
Place. Yeah.
Yeah, I know. But I don't, I can't even tell you who was number one, but number two was memorable.
So who was?
So who was this mysterious lady?
And this mysterious person is none but Halle Berry.
The one that got away. That's now, where I get, that's what I, that's the conclusion.
So, so this is, this
I can't find the picture you sent
This is
either.
Before Mrs. Stupard, so it's all in the clear. But yeah. It's, you didn't just meet her. You were in the pageant.
Yes.
So tell us about that. What was your role in Miss World 1986?
Well, you know, so so for those pageants, we basically escort the ladies. We actually talk to them. We kind of, I don't see... entertain them during the off time. But we're like, you know, so we talk to them, we'll go out to dinner as they get ready and prepare, and we sing, and then...
So you sang and wooed her with your engineering
and
ability.
Well, I was too ugly. I didn't do that. Well, I'm sure she. I'm sure if I look like John, you know, like cool and I mean, stuff, she would have looked at me. But back then,
But he did. He came in with. He escorted her in the evening wear competition while he's in his white uniform.
I can't find the picture.
And legend says that this may have inspired other young people to join the U.S.
Yeah,
Navy.
They basically said it was Tom Cruise and that young lieutenant. That was escorting that the young lady, but yeah, Craig has it. I cannot find where you sent it.
Yeah.
So, but I think I had a footage of it. I zoomed in.
Yes.
And it looks like she's whispering to you, "What's your phone number?" And you're just like, "Haha, I'm too honor bound. Can't give you that."
So we go from escorting Halle Berry to back to ships.
Back to ships. Yes.
To boats.
So spent about 2 years in aviation. Yeah, but I found out that the true and real engineering is actually in ships, boats. Yeah, because as a flyer, I realized that I'm more like a bus driver. Because, you know, it's like, yeah.
we're going to definitely use that on our pilot students.
Bus driver, because it's like, hey, I want to fix them. I want to play. They say, no. As an officer, you don't touch the airplanes. You fly them. And we get them ready for you. You fly them, and when you're done, you park it, and we'll take it from there. I'm like, I want to play with it. I want to touch it. He said, nope, as an officer, you don't do that. As a flyer, you don't do that. I'm really an engineer, so I like to play with things, mess with things. And they say, hey, if you really want to do that, if you go on ships, there, they let officers play with ships, pumps, and the things like that. And I requested to switch to ships, and I went on ships and I loved it so much so I spent 10 years straight on ships. Normally people go one ship, you take a break, 3 years, 2 years break, ship again, you take a break. Me, I just did 10 years of ship duties, and people thought I was crazy, but hey, I was enjoying it.
He loves ships more than Howard Mortman.
Yeah,
that's a joke for you, Howard.
Yes, that's our C-SPAN fan.
All right.
As we wrap up here, let's get. We haven't actually got to the Sea Dog leadership mantra.
Yeah, so he's got some.
We need to get that.
He's got
there.
Leadership tips throughout the book,
which Craig definitely needs.
Yeah, I do. I do. I need you to lead me.
I know.
We all need John to lead us.
So, but we've got again some that came across. Were things that seem, for some leaders, don't seem to matter. Like you said, the details matter.
Yes.
That the idea of also being able, having a good memory matters. Mm. So these are things that, you know, they may not sound like your traditional, you know, Navy captain. These are rah-rah leadership techniques. These are more finer points. So can you take us through some of the finer points of leadership that you may have picked up, but that you wouldn't have gotten in the Captain 101 course?
Yes. Let's see. One of them, like you said, it's important to cultivate your memory and being able to remember things. Because one of the simple skills in leadership, it may be of no value, but it is important to remember that people are people, regardless of who they are, mm-hmm. what they do. They are just people at heart. And then there's a magic when I say, hey, John, how are you today? As opposed to like, what's your name again? Because in leadership position, you meet so many people. You're like the mm-hmm. fish in that fishbowl, right? Everybody's looking at you and they all know your name. John Michalczyk, I'm the big guy. Well, I own the world.
Everyone knows John.
I go by the high chief.
Especially on Saipan, he is beloved.
Yes, yes. You know, everybody knows him. But then the 300, maybe John knows 10, 15, or 20. But when number 296 or mm-hmm. 400, 500 come to see you, that you have like, do I know you somewhere?
Who are you?
Yeah, who are you? Do I know you somewhere? So it is important to have that quick memory thing to like, hey, I met you. I remember seeing you. And they're like, oh, me? Why would you remember me? I'm like a nobody. And you, the big John, the big chief, actually, you know me. And that by itself is big.
That's what happens when I step foot in Saipan.
John also doesn't know any student that doesn't play football.
Frisbee, yeah. Well, we'll get there. Now, you have a good mantra. And I like it because it's short, yes. It's concise, it's brief.
Yep.
Do good, be good.
Yes.
How did this come to be?
Well, it came to be because part of being a commanding officer is to go to the selection board, and then you have to go in front of four or five other commanding officers who actually commanding ships, and that you sit down in person in front of them, and they just ask you questions, oral board questions. And I knew that one of the questions they were going to ask is about your command philosophy. What is your command philosophy if you're selected to be a commanding officer? How are you going to lead the crew? So you know, I was thinking about that, preparing for that. And then I wanted something simple that I can use that's memorable, but that is actually that people can actually remember and associate with. And then somehow putting all my thoughts and ideas together in terms of, you know, the character and virtues of a person, you know, because the leader is actually a person, a character, and that's what makes it important. And then the next element of that is actually your work. Right. So you're a leader. You could be a great leader and you do, you know, stupid work. Or you could be great work and be a really dumb leader. Yeah. But how do you put those two together? And based on that thought process, I said, what I want my crew, the people that I'm going to lead, what I want all of them to be and to do throughout my command is for them to be good and do good work. And I was able to put it in a very succinct way that on the USS Arleigh Burke, destroyer number 51, everybody, if you talk to them from the highest to the lowest person, you say, what is the captain's command philosophy? They'll tell you, be good and do good work. Even up to this day, after 20 years later, I have people who still use it. And one of them is Congresswoman Ellen Luria. At a speech at Virginia Wesleyan University, she said, my mantra as a congresswoman is be good and do good work, and I have permission to use it from Captain Stupard because her husband was my operations officer, my ops officer, and the husband used to go home, Rob Blunden. Rob used to go home and talk to her about be good and do good work because it's about being good yourself, like John, right? If I want to give you an example, just be good as John. And then the other part, do good work. So you do good work like Craig. So you get the both of both worlds right there.
That's fine.
Be I'll good like that. John and We're do good work like
the,
Craig.
The two-headed
and
monster.
You'll be in good shape.
So John's got a line he likes to jokingly say when we ask him to make a decision. And he often says, toxic leadership is still leadership.
True.
So I want you to respond about is toxic leadership still leadership? Because this is always a hot button topic about, you know.
Yes. Topic leadership is still leadership. but it's leadership in the negative.
So I, downhill. So I'm fundamentally still correct. So yeah, I stand by it.
It's still leadership, but in the other direction. Because I said, actually, leadership, if you really think about it, leadership, the only difference between a great leader and a mediocre leader is one letter. S and Z. S and Z. Just one letter. So the great leader zaps you with energy. And the toxic leader saps the energy the heck out of you. So there it is. A toxic leader is still a leader, but it saps all the energy out. Okay. Once, when they walk into the room, you're like, oh, man, what did I sign up for?
So that's what Craig's students say in his elective.
as opposed to creating weariness, I think that's the
question. Yeah, that's a weary leader. All right. So that's a good bit.
So we're going to go to our final question, and this is a question we ask everyone.
I totally forgot.
We ask our students, so this is your oral comp, and so since you've been through PME, you should have a good answer for this, and we are grading you. And the question is, what is war?
Man, I've spent 50 years thinking about this term. You know, I went to the Naval War College back in 1998-99 and followed that immediately with JPM Phase 2. I was a student here, Seminar 6, in 1999. And from there, I went to the Pentagon. I was there on 9/11. And have had five commands thinking about what is war. And war is inevitable. Will always have war. As long as you have people, you will have war. Because it's about power, control, and also defense. So war is about being able to defend what's dear and worthwhile to you. Because there's always someone who doesn't have what you have, who wants what you have. So war is basically people who don't have, trying to get what you want. And in the defensive aspect is defending what's valuable to you. So war is basically the quid pro quo between human interactions, offense and defense.
So it's a little mix of Clausewitz with Thucydides?
Is there some Sun Tzu in there, though?
So we'll just ignore that. So, like, again, solid 88. It's pretty good.
B plus. Yes! I pass again.
So, yeah, so on that note, it was good. And we won't have to edit that one out. So that's good. Well done. So on that note,
be good. Do good.
Be elite.